In a debate held January 2, 2006, hosted by Stuart Brand and the Long Now Foundation, Ralph Kavanaugh of the NRDC explains why we don't need nuclear power to solve the world's energy problems.
So at the outset, I need to acknowledge that I have, since 1979, had the best job in the entire environmental community. I'm the Energy Program Co-Director for the Natural Resources Defense Council, which bills itself as a national environmental organization, but let's be serious. Two of the four offices are in California. A fifth of the membership is in California. I think that I have heard from a good fraction of it in the last 2 weeks, giving me advice on exactly what to do this evening. Not all of it consistent. I thought the best suggestion was that I should remind Peter that solar power is a nuclear fuel, and if he will just expand his definition a little, he'll bring the audience along with it. Let me explain. I have, it's my belief, and what I'm going to describe is fundamentally an optimistic vision, which is, I think, actually very much like Peter's was. I don't think nuclear power is going to figure in your future. Not because I'm afraid of it, but because I think there are much better alternatives available. Actually, I am a little bit afraid of it, and I'll get to that in a moment. But I believe we can and will do better. And I actually think the state of California is a wonderful proving ground for doing better, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Let me give you a sense of my skepticism. By the way, without in any way, as I said, I accept Peter's statement of the problem. I take the climate change challenge every bit as seriously as he does, and I think he set it out about right. We've got to think about the global challenge. I'd put it this way. I think what we have to do is we have to wean the world from fossil fuels over the next century. Peter ended a memorable article by reminding you all that the Stone Age didn't end when the world ran out of stones, and that's not an impossible proposition, and we've been through things like this before. And so over the next 50 years, my view is that we, and I think this is broadly consistent with where a number of our climate scientists are, we've got to try and stabilize global emissions, and we've got to try to cut U.S. emissions roughly in half. And I don't minimize the difficulty of doing that for one instant. It's a formidable challenge. And many people who look at that challenge come to the conclusion that Peter does, that, gee, we need everything. We need to do everything we could possibly. We need all the efficiency, all the renewables, all the coal, all the nuclear. We do the coal, we have to pump the carbon underground. We have to do everything. This I would describe as the working philosophy of the United States Congress on every energy policy issue of consequence over the last 50 years. We have to do everything. There is, I would submit to all of you, an alternative way of thinking about this in a world with limited resources. And that is to say, rather than letting government pick the winners and losers on the merits, which is an idea that in every other context would cause the Peter that I know to recoil in horror, rather than do that here, we ought to be moving toward a paradigm which is much more comfortable to the Peter Schwartz I know, which is that what we ought to be setting up is what we ought to be having government do is establish the limits, the pollution limits. We ought to be having government say, look, even as we've done with other major pollutants, we're going to limit the amount of greenhouse gases that get emitted, and then we're going to let the winners and losers emerge on the merits depending on what the least costly ways are of achieving that objective. That is an approach we have pursued in other contexts. I would submit it's the approach we should pursue here, and I want to give you my reasons for thinking that if we do, nuclear is unlikely to be among the winners. Now, first of all, again, I hope this is a kind of disarmingly reasonable proposition. If you take this stuff seriously, the answer surely isn't to have the government decide what technologies to deploy, which hasn't worked tremendously well in many sectors. It's to have the government do what it does best, which is set reasonable regulatory constraints and limits, and then let the entrepreneurial genius that Peter Schwartz exemplifies as well as anybody I know figure out what to do. Now, if you do that, here's why I'm skeptical that nuclear emerges among the winners. I'm going to wish away several problems. I'm going to assume that there are no operational safety issues. I'm going to assume that there are no problems associated with potential terrorist attacks or sabotage on relatively vulnerable spent fuel pools, although I worry, as many of you do, that that's certainly a temptation out there that gets bigger as you have more and more reactors. But remember, Peter has directed you to imagine a better reactor. So that's fine. I'm going to wish that away, too. I still think we end up with three big problems as we envision a very substantial expansion of nuclear. The first is that in order to get to Peter's world of better reactors, you've somehow got to get the existing world of existing reactors, you've got to get it past the waste problem. And the waste proposition really has proved, in 1984, the United States Congress passed legislation to force the state of Nevada to accept nuclear waste by the year 1998, which seemed like a straightforward proposition. It's a small state, relatively powerless. All of the rest of us want to do this. There's 14 years. Let's get this done, for heaven's sake, and move on. It's 2006. We are nowhere close to doing that. Now, I think Peter is right to say, let's change the value proposition here. Instead of getting highly toxic waste for several hundred thousand years, instead you'll be accepting waste for a mere century or so in large concrete casks. But even Peter Schwartz is going to have a tough time selling that to the skeptical jurisdictions that are going to believe in their heart of hearts that maybe, just maybe, nobody's going to want those casks after the first century, and they're going to be stuck with them indefinitely. Or, as is the case with the existing reactors, maybe the waste just stays on the existing sites and piles up. I don't think this is the worst problem that nuclear power has, but it is a formidable political challenge that nobody's figured out how to overcome. But let's assume Peter overcomes it, and we deal with that, and Yucca Mountain fills to the brim with the wastes of the existing reactors, and everybody forgets about this issue when we go forward. It still seems to me that there are two formidable problems, and I was trying to begin to tease them out as we were talking together. The first has to do with this issue of the linkage between nuclear power and nuclear bombs, which is impossible for any of us to escape, since any of us who is watching the daily coverage of events in Iran and North Korea can see it. I mean, Iran and North Korea's fundamental argument to the rest of the world is, what, weapons? We're just building nuclear reactors, just like the United States. This is civilian power. What's the problem? We're just doing what all the rest of you are doing. And the problem, of course, as everybody who is involved in this recognizes, is the deceptive ease with which those civilian programs become cover for illicit activity. Very hard to police. There's no question, I think, that we'd have a safer world in terms of long-term nuclear proliferation issues if there were no civilian nuclear industries for the weapons masters to hide behind. And one of the reasons to look forward to a nuclear-free era, if we can get to it, is that civilian cover will be gone. But here is the final reason why I think, and the most important, why I doubt that nuclear will figure in your future. And it has to do with the fundamental self-confidence that I want all of you to feel about the competition that I suspect many of you value above the nuclear option in terms of where you want to see the world's energy future go. The energy efficiency options, to have energy efficiency and renewable energy appear as two items on a list is, for any of you who know the diversity of these technologies and options, of course, very misleading and constraining. We're talking about literally thousands of options. We're talking about the ability to create portfolios combined both out of efficiency, a whole host of renewable electric generation, the biofuels options that we haven't even started to talk about yet this evening. All I am seeking in my advocacy and what I'm trying to accomplish is an equal opportunity for them to compete against the nuclear plants and the other options. I am a little bit amused when the issue arises, should nuclear power be on the table or not? Nuclear power has been on the table for my entire life, which has spanned most of the life cycle. It's never been off the table. It has an army of lobbyists in Washington, with funding at least 100 times those of every anti-nuclear activist in the country. It has 100 plus operating reactors in the U.S., each with 1,000 plus employees. It has university centers across the country. It has a whole army of committee chairs in the Congress supporting it aggressively. It has freedom for it has complete protection, or largely complete protection, against accident liability. It has subsidies for licensing, subsidies for siting, operating subsidies, loan guarantees for the next generation of plant. I think Peter would be hard-pressed to think of anything else one could do right now to put nuclear even more firmly on the table. And yet, this is the extraordinary thing. Not one nuclear plant has been ordered and completed since 1973. I suspect before the births of many in this room. And that is because, at least in this country, nuclear has time and time again failed fundamental competitive tests. And this is, I think, the fundamental reason for my confidence that better options will prevail, is that I expect the future to be a reprise of those competitive tests. Now, the competitive tests in the future, I think Peter's right, they'll be carbon constrained. That is, you'll get points if you have relatively low carbon dioxide emissions, and nuclear will get some points. Nuclear's been getting points all its life. It still can't win. Giving it a few more is unlikely to change the outcome, particularly since the same kinds of options, the options with equally appealing low carbon characteristics, will be getting the same benefit in those competitive contexts. So what you're going to see, and you'll see it first in California, as California moves, as it already has, toward constraints on carbon emissions. The governor has set aggressive targets to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. I know Peter and I celebrate that first move. Now he's got to act on it. Likeliest way he acts on it is, and it's already starting to happen, you begin to put your thumb on the scale. You begin to say, we want to develop our electric options with an eye toward minimizing carbon emissions. Today, in a historic moment, which I suspect not many of you have heard about yet, so I want to make sure you're aware of it, California PUC has proposed to limit the total carbon emissions associated with the resource purchases of the state's major utilities. And that process, as it gets underway, and yes, absolutely, that's worth a moment. I'm going to commemorate something else in just a moment to when I close that's even more important. But what that reminds us is that we are moving into a carbon-constrained era, but think about what that has meant in recent years for California. We've already started to do it. Did you know, for example, that when California utilities evaluate energy efficiency against renewables, against coal, against nuclear, they are required to assign a penalty, a cost penalty, to resources that emit carbon dioxide. So nuclear is already getting a thumb on the scale in California. Hasn't made a noticeable difference yet. What has happened is that we've launched the world's largest energy efficiency and renewable energy investment programs. And that is, frankly, what I think, and here's where I sometimes get into trouble, but I want to bring you this far with me. I think Peter's right on one point. I think nuclear gets to compete. I don't think we can say we want low carbon auctions, we want a fair competitive, we want to go after all the cost effective efficiency, all the renewables, and we're just going to rule nuclear out of that competition. They can't possibly make a showing. It makes us sound like we're scared of the nuclear option. It makes it sound like we think maybe there's something good out there that might beat our stuff, so we want to keep it away. We want to rule it out. We shouldn't be doing that. We should be saying and meaning we can take them on and beat them just as we've taken them on and beaten them for the last 30 years straight. Often in situations, if you think about the remarkable fact of no orders since 1973, we're not just talking about no orders in California. We're talking about the whole country. We're talking about the Southeast. We're talking about some places which, in ideological terms at least, are quite different from the audience spread out in front of me this evening. And you know, the most important reason for that, in the years since 1973, more than 100 nuclear reactors were canceled, many in an advanced state of construction, not because protesters went after them, but because the cost spiraled out of control. And the utilities that sponsored those plants had to eat about $60 billion, most of which they weren't allowed to pass on to customers. That creates vivid and enduring memories. And so somehow you have the interesting challenge in the United States, if you want a nuclear revival, in addition to everything else I've told you, you've got to overcome that rather vivid and eloquent history. And what I would want to say to all of you is that I see no evidence at this point that the nuclear plants can do it. Now, what Peter is telling you is imagine a better nuclear plant. And the difficulty with imagining a better nuclear plant is they will have to, that means the existing infrastructure is not going to be terribly helpful. We're moving to something completely different. The first few are going to cost a lot more. They're going to create some significant financial risk. The utilities that are being asked to take on that risk will be wanting lots of help from the taxpayers of the United States. And this is a message I'll keep coming back with you on. The resources of the United States right now, the public resources, are constrained. There is a limited amount available for public subsidy of any resource, and the notion that somehow there's going to be a willingness to make the public investment necessary to create resources of this scale. And remember, this is the fundamental problem with a nuclear plant. Think of how big they are. Think of how long they take to build. Think of how much of a system's capital and operating capacity they take up. And they're surrounded by smaller and nimbler competitors, the efficiency options, the renewable options. To bring this home to you, I wanted to close with a hometown example. For nuclear activists over the last quarter century, the institution you most love to hate, at least if you went back to when I started NRDC in 1979, was the bad old Pacific Gas and Electric Company. The Aaron Brockovich utility, the people who couldn't shoot straight, the Diablo Canyon blueprint switchers. Today, your hometown utility, the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, is the largest investor in energy efficiency in the world. It will shortly be very likely the largest investor in renewable energy. And as a result of the PUC's actions on solar this week, which many of you contributed to, the largest investor in solar. It's running a resource procurement program that's acutely conscious of carbon risk. And by the way, if you look at the future that PG&E is now charting, it's not that there's no nuclear in it, and there's no coal in it, of course, either. What they're trying to do is to build a future around efficient use of waste heat in natural gas applications. They're trying to add a lot more renewables, and they're trying to do more energy efficiency than any other utility in the world has ever done. And I would submit to all of you that that's the model. And what I want to close on is there is someone here in this room who helped start that revolution at PG&E. And it's Carl Weinberg, who's sitting right there, is the former head of R&D. And it's his birthday tonight, and I would appreciate it if you would all Let him know that you appreciate it. And so I want you to take away from these remarks not a sense of a relentless attack on a particular technology, but a sense of boundless enthusiasm and optimism about its competitors, and the hope that all of us together will watch the most effective international demonstration that those competitors can and will prevail over the long term right here in California. Thank you.